You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tekert. Our next topic, how banks run the regulators. 10 years ago, Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy, triggered an implosion in the world of finance, and took a big chunk of the real economy with it. Suddenly, the American public got acquainted with terms like collateralized debt obligation, credit default swap, and systemic risk. And the federal government sprang into action. First to bail out the financial firms at the center of the crisis, then to stimulate the larger economy, and finally to try to rein in some of the worst excesses that had produced the crisis in the first place. Shortly after the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill got signed into law, our next guest made the move from working for large banks to regulating them. She took a job at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, where she was assigned to Goldman Sachs. She was shocked by what she saw, what she was told to do, what she was told to not do. And that is the topic of Carmen Segarra's new book, Noncompliant: A Lone Whistleblower Exposes the Giants of Wall Street. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you want to move from the private sector into the Federal Reserve in the first place?
That's a really good question. And of course, there's a lot of there's a personal component tied to it. The way the industry sort of worked at the time in the field in which I work, where there's a lot of price discovery and it's very much an up or out culture, I had essentially reached the top. I was close to 40. This is typically when people get pushed out, if you will. And I was actually had been interviewing for opportunities abroad because essentially with my skill set, the next logical move was to leave the U.S., actually. But I fell in love with someone and I didn't want to leave. So this opportunity came up. And I thought, well, you know, this is a good fit for my skill set. I want to try to stay longer because my relationship was going really well. And so I took the job at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Your job with several banks had been in compliance. It was your job to help them figure out what the laws were, how they applied, how to stay on the right side of them.
Yeah, it was in legal and compliance. I mean, at the time, there was a lot of merging of those two departments, essentially because there had been a lot of upgrading in the personnel. When you have such complicated laws at some point, it really doesn't make sense to have compliance officers that don't have law degrees enforcing or setting up compliance programs. So there was a lot of a crossover, and I am a lawyer by training, so it made sense. I was part of that generation that was sort of asked to set up jointly these legal / compliance programs. And it was also as a result of Glass-Steagall. I mean, when I think about it, I was class of 98 for law school, and so I was one of the first classes to graduate in a post-Glass-Steagall environment. So what that meant from a practical standpoint is that as a lawyer, I was asked to master both the banking and the securities products and services, and got paid only for, you know, half of the work, if you will. But what it does is that I'm sort of part of the first generation of people that actually can tackle both products in the U.S. This is actually very common abroad because mm-hmm. there is no Glass-Steagall, but it's unusual in the U.S. for people who are older than me. They just don't have that experience.
Because previously the Glass-Steagall rule had kept those two lines of business entirely separate.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So what did you think? You take a job at the Federal Reserve, you'd essentially be doing the same thing only for a different employer?
What I really was just a legal maid. I mean, essentially my job was just going around and, you know, setting up or cleaning up messes or setting up proper programs, and often a combination of both. So when I interviewed at the Federal Reserve, I was, you know, very much aware that there was a mess. They had a mess in terms of their regulatory department, their supervision department. And of course, there were regulatory capture issues. And I was sort of brought in to clean up both issues, if you will.
Explain what you mean by regulatory capture.
Well, I mean, I don't actually like that term. I think collusion is a more accurate term to use. But that's sort of the non-lawyers way of saying, you know, people who instead of doing their jobs of supervising the banks are actually helping the banks cover up what they're doing. And so for me, it was actually not difficult to see the problem. It's like, you know, within days, I was attending meetings where Goldman Sachs executives were, you know, lying, misrepresenting, and double speaking their way through meetings without any fear of repercussions. And within days, I was attending meetings where, you know, supervisors at the Federal Reserve, you know, peers and people who were more senior, were proactively and deliberately not doing their jobs and doing what they could to suppress evidence and to obstruct supervision. So the problem was pretty clear. The question was, how is this going to get fixed? And is it even possible to do that?
Let's take those a step at a time. First of all, like, what were the types of things that Goldman Sachs would lie about in those meetings?
Let's just say for the purposes of discussion, you know, we're asking them, did you do this transaction the way you're supposed to do it? And they are saying, yes, we did. We did nothing wrong. And so when you fast forward to a few months later, there's a judge issuing an opinion in a lawsuit that had been filed against Goldman saying, you know, you guys didn't do this right. And it would behoove you to settle this case as soon as possible before more things come out. So, you know, the lies were big and small, and, you know, from a legal and compliance standpoint, they sort of, you know, they touch different legal and compliance points. And, you know, the problem is, of course, that lying to a Federal Reserve Bank of New York supervision employee is a crime. So
the central issue in this transaction is that Goldman Sachs is the advisor on Kinder Morgan selling itself to El Paso. But Goldman Sachs also owns a piece of El Paso and doesn't have a conflict of interest policy.
Yes, there were other issues as well. And for us, it wasn't just the conflicts of interest policy issue. For us, there are a lot of, you know, old and new regulations that support how these transactions need to be carried out. And so there was a lot more to it than that, but, you know, we can sort of use that as sort of like a baseline for the discussion, if you will. But it went far beyond that.
And when you said your colleagues at the Federal Reserve didn't want to proactively intercede when it was clear that Goldman was lying to you, why not? Like, what incentives do they operate under?
That's a very good question. And what I like to tell people is that it really, and what I try to do in the book is sort of, you know, individualize these people and sort of share their individual stories and try to make it clear that for different people, the motivations are different based on their particular situations. I mean, I think it's misleading to sort of say this is just a revolving door. I think, you know, for some people it is, but for most people, it's actually an escalator. You know, they are incentivized to get promotions. They get very well paid. They have two pension plans, one of which is a defined benefits pension plan. So if you want to get a promotion, you need to do what you're told. And as some of them sort of talk about, you know, some of them felt like they were tricked into doing something that wasn't right. And after that, they couldn't really leave. Some of them felt like they had, you know, financial circumstances that would hold them back, you know, divorces to pay, children to pay. And some of them sort of, you know, realized that if they actually had to go back to private practice, they would have to actually work, which is not something that anybody that works at the Federal Reserve does. And so it's misleading because they, you know, yes, you do get paid more in the private sector, but you're working 2 to 3 times, you know, harder. Just longer hours, you actually have to deliver. And these people aren't doing anything. So, you know, when you look at it on a per hour basis, and the fact that they're just expected to not do anything, it's a really good gig, which is why most people stay for a very long time. So I think the motivations are just different for different people.
But behind all of this, it sounds like you're describing a widespread expectation that riding the banks hard, or at least riding Goldman hard, is going to be bad for your prospects of staying at or advancing within the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, that's correct. And there's a scene in the book where I talk about how, you know, it's sort of, there's this, you know, sense of fear that sort of permeates the book and that sort of, you know, oozes out of these people. And then towards the end, you see a scene where Goldman pushed the Fed to push another regulator to fire one of their employees because Goldman didn't like the very good questions that regulator was asking.
So I guess my question is, like, where does Goldman's power come from in that relationship? Is it from the promise of future jobs for people who do leave the Federal Reserve?
I think it's a carrot and a stick. I think it's really the power, their ability to destroy people's careers or destroy their ability to work in this industry by getting them fired. I think that has even more of an influence.
Can you describe the first time you found yourself in direct conflict with the people you were ostensibly regulating at Goldman?
Typically, you are always in an adversarial or conflicting position, right? I mean, you're there to supervise the rules and you start asking questions and, you know, they either answer or not. I mean, I can tell you that it was not right away because for the most part, for the first 2 or 3 months, what you really do try to do and what I was encouraged to do was just to keep my mouth shut and follow my supervisor around whom I was going to be ostensibly replacing. So I think from an empathy standpoint or from sitting, you know, facing Goldman's standpoint, I mean, I could see that the conflicts were there from the very beginning, right? But sort of directly in conflict with them, again, it depends on whether it's substantive or personal, right? I mean, I think I remember, and there's a scene in the book that talks about meeting the head of the regulatory group for Goldman. And she sort of asked me a question about my previous experience, sort of really questioning whether it was true that I had had any specific job that I had sort of alluded to. And, you know, the scene sort of goes on and it's a little bit like, you know, well, you know, I was kind of hoping that she wouldn't go there. And I tried to throw her an olive branch and sort of say, you know, maybe, you know, I did have that job, you know, but she wouldn't have it. And so, you know, that sort of puts you in a situation where you either have to put the person in their place or not, you know, and she made it very difficult for me not to put her in her place. And so, you know, not to give anything away, but I went ahead and did. And I think that, you know, you could argue that that was sort of the first signal to them that I wasn't necessarily going to be playing along.
How would you describe Goldman's attitude towards regulators?
Time and again, you saw in meeting after meeting, these managers, these, you know, people who are running these different divisions, openly laughing at regulators, openly sort of saying that they were just not going to be complying with the law because they didn't think they had to. And that is just a very scary attitude if you think about it, because these people are supervising a whole bunch of people that work in their departments at Goldman. And it, you know, you can very easily extrapolate from there that they're just not complying with the rule of law, and they aren't. And so what kind of systemic risk are we injecting into our banking system when we allow one bank to openly not comply with the rule of law?
Yeah. What happened when you raised those issues inside the Fed?
Well, I mean, the book sort of walks you through that dance, right? I mean, I think it's not a straight line from there to getting fired. You sort of see the Fed trying to figure out how to digest it, right? And it was a difficult thing for them to digest because there is a level of consciousness that they are supposed to be enforcing these rules, which makes their deliberate decision to not enforce them all the more disturbing. I mean, I think as a taxpayer, I found it deeply disturbing to see how my taxpayer dollars were being misused by these people. I mean, time and again, just trying to suppress evidence. And I think, you know, I talk a lot in the book about how I'm trying to go about doing my job and how I'm like in meeting after meeting running into these fellow Federal Reserve Bank of New York regulators who are just determined to make sure that Goldman's record is wiped clean. And, you know, you fast forward to today, these people got promoted. You know, Bill Dudley, even after my tapes came out even after the congressional hearing, which, you know, makes for a fun read after reading my book. Then sort of he went ahead and promoted the people, some of the people who were involved directly in trying to suppress evidence. And that's shocking, you know, and deeply disturbing to me.
When you were fired, you went through the formal process. You filed a whistleblower lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you describe what that process is like from the plaintiff's side?
For me, it was a very difficult process to sort of decide whether or not to even file it. I mean, I think for me, there were two parallel processes, right? One was sort of thinking, you know, is this something that I even want to do? And then the second one being sort of logistically how you go about doing it. So for me, it was not personal. It's more my doing my civic duty. I mean, this is, you know, the health of our banking system is not a Democratic issue. It's not a Republican issue. It's not even an independent issue. It's a national issue with worldwide impact. Everybody who depends on a U.S. dollar to pay their bills, to take care of their families, needs to care about our banking system, the health of our banking system. It should be front and center. And we really do need to make a fundamental change in the way that we staff our supervision, in the way that we supervise our banks. And I think my book makes a very compelling case that these powers should be stripped away from the Federal Reserve.
But if not the Federal Reserve, then who?
And that's a very good question, to which I don't have the monopoly on the answer. I mean, I think that, you know, my job is really to just sort of bring what I think is a very important, very real, very well-documented story about what's really going on to light. I would say it would probably behoove us to look at how the central banking systems of other countries that are AAA countries, that remain AAA countries to the last crisis, are run. And what they do is they completely separate the supervision of the conduct rules from the monetary policy into different agencies. Some of them take all of the conduct rules, no matter which products, banking, securities, insurance, and put them all under one regulator. And some of them keep them under several regulators. I don't think that that's a determinative factor, but I do think that stripping the Federal Reserve of its supervision powers is an important first step. We already have state regulators that supervise banks. We already have federal regulatory agencies that supervise banks. Stripping them is not going to leave us without supervision. How do you fix the second problem in terms of keeping multiple agencies and having them continue to compete against each other? How do you incentivize those employees to actually do their jobs? I am not unaware of the fact that there are problems at other regulatory agencies. How do you incentivize that? I think that's where we need the village to come in and sort of take a hard look and start, you know, throw in some good ideas.
I mean, the argument for the Federal Reserve playing that role of regulating banks is that of all the arms of government, it is the most firewalled from electoral politics.
And that's precisely the problem. I mean, my book makes it clear. These people are, they're taking taxpayer money and they are throwing it down the toilet. They are not doing their jobs. They are incapable of doing supervision. And precisely because they're hidden away from public view, nobody knows about this. And I think that anybody who reads this book should be in absolutely no doubt that this is just, you know, the worst possible setup for Americans, because we're paying and getting nothing. There is no transparency in the Federal Reserve. There is zero accountability in the Federal Reserve. After I blew the whistle, Janet Yellen and Bill Dudley worked proactively to withhold information from Congress and to advocate for less transparency, less accountability. You know, it's like I've kept in touch with regulators since then. Nothing has changed. They have moved in terms of further silencing them. And the book sort of makes that clear as well. And that is going to continue to be the way that they're going to operate. It is important, imperative, that we strip the regulatory powers away from them. We cannot continue to lie to ourselves and think that they are doing any kind of supervision. They are simply not doing it. On the contrary, they are suppressing information, deleting information that should be in the books and records of the Federal Reserve, and they are making sure that the banks are not getting supervised.
So given what you saw inside the New York branch of the Federal Reserve, where would you, how would you rate the stability of our banking system now? Are we at risk of repeating 2008?
Yes, I think we're in a worse position than we were before 2008 because nothing has changed. Nobody was held accountable. The Fed has not done anything in terms of supervision or holding people accountable. And right now we are running a debt economy. We have more debt than we did in 2008, more public debt, that is. And therefore, the government has less firepower to utilize the creation of money to bail us out of the next crisis.
But there are fewer forms of elaborate entanglement in the world of finance, right? The exotic derivatives that were partially responsible for the 2008 crisis, some of them have been made impossible by new rules.
And they've already been relaunched under different names. I saw an article the other day, sort of like an industry article from in the legal world, sort of pointing to the fact that CDOs have been relaunched with different names. I mean, the book talks about...
CDOs are short for collateralized debt obligations.
Yes, collateralized debt obligations. And the book also talks about how what brought down Lehman was a product that was being sold again by Goldman. And the book sort of walks you through the transaction where Goldman made, where Goldman went ahead and sold that very product, you know, packaged in a slightly different way. These, you know, the laws and the rules and the regulations that are in place have not really forbidden any of these products. And I do think that, you know, it's not an issue, it's not just an issue of what products are allowed or what products are not allowed. I mean, I think from if you live in a capitalist society, you're always going to have creative people that are going to come up with a different way of packaging a product if there is a demand or a need for it and people are willing to buy it. I think the bigger issue is the haphazard enforcement of the existing rules. I mean, these risks were built in the bank, in the books of banks and financial institutions because they all they got were occasional slap on the wrist when journalists made some noise so that the, you know, the people would keep quiet and think that things were being done. That's essentially how these risks are built in banking books. And we have not changed that in any fundamental way, so we should not expect a different result.
Yeah, that's a real interesting inversion from how I think most Americans think about politics, that politics is a place where we fight over what the rules will be, and we take for granted that those rules will be implemented and enforced. You're saying in the world of banking, the rules themselves are actually less important than the political will of the people whose job it is to implement them.
Yeah, but I'm also saying that we live in a system where every single institution that is supposed to protect or act as a fail-safe has and is continuing to fail the American people. We have all of the fail-safes in the system to try that can be used to step up and force, you know, supervisors to do their job or do the job for supervisors if they aren't doing it, are just not stepping up. And that is a cultural issue. That is a systemic issue. You know, how is it that we have allowed the systems to become corrupted in the way they have been, where it is where the critical mass of employees who actually go there and do their jobs just isn't there? And I think this is a much bigger issue that we need to take a look at.
Yeah. Do you think it's partly a size problem that firms like Goldman Sachs have gotten so large that their political clout is inevitably bigger than that of the people who are supposed to regulate them, that the only real solution would be breaking up the firms?
No, I don't think it's an issue of size, simply because in the rest of the world, most banks, and it's very interesting to look at the tables of the biggest banks in the world, where U.S. banks no longer really are part of that list, where they used to be 10, 15 years ago. But most of the rest of the world, banks are much bigger than Goldman.
It's just a very politically connected
bank. Exactly. It's a politically connected bank, but it's actually not a big bank, and it's not a very well diversified bank in terms of products and services. I think it's an issue of mismanagement.
Do you think there are some banks that should just be put down?
Yeah, starting with Goldman. I mean, that bank should, you know, based on what I saw, that bank should have been shut down. And the tools are there. We don't need to enact any new laws, rules, or regulations for that. We just need to get regulators to do their jobs. The book sort of really goes well beyond what has been sort of written about to point out that it's just, there are systemic legal and compliance issues within every division of Goldman Sachs. And attitudes in terms of we don't have to comply with the law that are just fundamentally insurmountable because they are cultural. How do you restaff a bank from scratch with people who actually think it's a good idea to comply with the rule of law? That's really difficult. Those are systemic issues. They're cultural issues.
Carmen Segarra, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Carmen Segarra is an attorney and former regulator for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Her new book is Noncompliant: A Loan Whistleblower Exposes the Giants of Wall Street. Just about 8 o'clock in the morning here at KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, or K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, online around the world at www.kpfa.org. The program's up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Coming up in the second hour of our program, we're going to take the time to do a really deep dive on the Saudi war in Yemen. What the roots of the crisis are, who the various players on the ground and in the region are, what the humanitarian catastrophe there has to do with everything from larger movements in oil markets to geopolitics. Isaac Bloomie's new book is Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World, and we'll spend an hour on it next, after the news.